Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 4th. This is episode 13. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good, good.
It's another beautiful day here in the Midwest.
It is. Should be outside fertilizing my lawn and digging dandelions and doing all that awesome spring stuff.
My yard is rapidly approaching the least kept yard in the neighborhood, so
you're gonna start getting dirty looks.
People
are weird. People are weird about dandelions because you're like, when they go to seed, then you are contributing to the spread of dandelions to everybody else's yard.
So now I've got all of the materials to change the oil and the air filter and all of that stuff in my lawnmower, so that'll be this week's chore. So then I can actually go out and mow the grass like a concerned citizen.
Kind of crept up on us because it was warm and then it was cold for a while. And so I got back into hermit mode.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden it's...
It's 70 degrees.
Yeah. Everything's growing.
Okay. So let's start with this interesting article that you and I both found independently, but we're both fascinated by this New York Times article about... further science, I guess, that has been done on some of the Biggest Loser winners, right? And this article specifically profiled the guy who had lost the most on Biggest Loser. He'd lost like 239 pounds in 7 months. So this was the season 8 winner. And he when he started the show, he weighed, 430 pounds. And he doesn't weigh 430 pounds anymore, but he weighs, 295.
Yeah. So he's about 100 pounds heavier than when he finished the show.
And, he's still exercising, and he's still eating relatively well. I mean, not as well as you can be when there's a whole team of people around you, you know, almost force feeding you the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
The most astonishing thing was his resting metabolic rate, right? His metabolism slowed way down, right? So they, an astonishing amount. I don't remember what the number was. Mm-hmm. Something like 500 calories. No, he now has to eat
800 fewer calories than... And it wasn't just comparing to his body before. It was then a man his age, weight, and size, you know?
That's how much his metabolism has slowed down. Right? And it's not... You know, it slowed down when he was on the diet during the show. And then it just never went up again. Like his body has decided, you are now underweight, and I'm going to do all of the chemical things I need to do to make you eat more,
mm-hmm,
to gain all of this weight back that we lost. But 800 calories is a lot. I mean, that's like foregoing a whole meal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying I'm not having lunch, you know, every day for the rest of your life. It's a lot. So this is kind of a fascinating thing. The one question that I had that wasn't answered in this was, why does the metabolism slow? Is it because of the diet? Right? Is it because you're eating fewer calories when you're on a calorie-restricted diet? And maybe your body goes into some, starvation mode.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you've dramatically changed the content of what it is that you're eating, and that's causing some sort of, gut biome change? Is it because you've started exercising a lot and increasing your muscle mass.
See, and that's the thing that they didn't really, I mean, they can't really scientifically explain it. And that wasn't the focus of the article. The focus of the article was revealing what the research had discovered. And it's the smoking gun is that these people's metabolisms have been permanently altered to be less efficient, you know.
I don't know if it's permanently altered, well, but it's certainly altered for, you know, even after the diet.
So what are we? It's 7 years later.
Yeah.
So maybe not permanently, but that's a long time.
It is, but the question why is most important, because it, right. Does it mean that you're doing something wrong when you're dieting and exercising?
Yeah, I mean, my speculation... So, you know, I've always understood this concept of starvation mode. You know, if you don't eat enough food, your your metabolic rate will decrease. You will burn fewer calories. That people tend to kind of spring back from then. You know, you ramp up your calories again and you get back into... I mean, you know, people plateau losing weight and then you ramp up your calories, you know, and you start losing weight again. And mm-hmm. I feel like there's kind of some give and take. And that's why my speculation would be it's the exercising. It's the fact that they're spending, you know, 7 hours a day working out, you know, that they're actually physically changing the structure of their cells. Like their body is adapting to be, you know, a crazy person who's exercising for 7 hours a day. It's like their body suddenly thinks that they're like, you know, their occupation is requiring them to, you know, move that much, or, you know, their body is adapting to that level of activity.
And so that causes their metabolism to go lower in some sort of conservation mode.
Right. Because you're burning so many, I mean, you can't get around burning calories exercising. Yeah. I mean, it's fuel in order to keep moving, or you'll faint, you'll pass out, you'll collapse.
So I wonder if that means, does this gentleman, I don't remember what his name was, Danny?
Danny Cahill. So now when he's just sitting around at his office, I mean, his body is not burning any calories because it's got to save him.
Does he burn fewer calories per hour when he's on the treadmill than I do?
See, that I don't know. I would assume that exercising calories are the same because they... You know, the interesting thing here, so they looked at everybody who did season 8, everyone who was involved, and something like 13 out of the 14 people have gained significant weight, mm-hmm. and one person has continued to lose weight, and she works out nonstop. So it's like anyone who's willing to maintain the level of activity will keep the weight off. It's just that's not a normal thing to do. I mean, people who have jobs and lives can't exercise for, you know, even 2 hours a day.
Well, it feels to me like and this is, again, just speculation, but it seems that it is that their exercise is kind of radical.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, people who generally lose weight and keep it off have adopted some fundamental lifestyle changes, right? They've permanently altered their diet, usually by saying, you know, oh, I'm no longer going to drink any soda, and, you know, I generally don't have desserts or cookies or donuts or any of that stuff, right? They cut all of that stuff out, or they take it a step further and you know, adopt a vegetarian or a vegan diet or even a paleo diet, right? Some sort of diet that lets you more or less eat all that you want, but then cuts out whatever the diet has deemed to be the bad thing, right?
Right.
So when you make that lifestyle change, people almost always lose weight, and then assuming they maintain that changed lifestyle, whatever their new weight becomes, they maintain. And so it does, yeah, I guess
So that's so what they, I,
but why, yeah.
So that's the thing that I think is always, so I, do you even watch The Biggest Loser?
No, because I hardly watch television.
Yeah, I generally, I've watched it most seasons. Like, I really do like the show. It's the kind of show that I watch while I'm on the laptop doing something else, because you can't really pay attention to it for an hour because it's painfully, the pacing of it's painfully slow. Anyway, I think it's kind of interesting. And over the years, it's hard to get information about what happens, you know, where are they now type things, because these people have all signed various contracts and,
yep.
You know, I think that there are a lot of restrictions in place, you know, forever about what they can say about the show and their future and whatever. So plus, you know, if someone has lost a lot of weight, been very successful, and then they gain it all back, they, you know, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to be profiled. So it's actually pretty hard. You know, I've searched before, you know, to find out whatever happened to that person from Biggest Loser, this person. It's kind of hard to find information about where are they now, because, I mean, they're private individuals. So this is the first time that there's been like, I mean, this is in the New York Times. This was obviously had the blessing of the producers and stuff of the show.
Sure.
This is the first time that there's been a real like scientific result. And that's what I find really fascinating. The fact that, you know, it's not just one off, oh, this guy from that season gained back 200 pounds. It's like everyone in this control group, which was an entire season's worth of contestants,
gained weight. It makes you wonder, like, would NASA be interested in understanding what's going on here? Because if they could figure out how to
slow somebody's metabolism. Yeah,
how to reduce the calorie requirements of an astronaut by, say, 400 calories a day going to and from Mars. I mean, that's, you know, like a gazillion pounds of food mm-hmm. they don't have to ship over. I don't know. That's an interesting question. So
the other thing that was brought up in this article, and I've always heard this, that's as someone who has lost weight and gained weight and lost weight again, you know, I've always heard this kind of anecdotal thing that, you know, your fat cells never really go away. So someone who has lost a bunch of weight, it's easier to gain it back because those fat cells are still there just waiting to be filled back up. The article talked about that a little bit too, that's kind of the part that to me personally is a little depressing, you know?
That's the scary part?
Yeah, I mean, well, kind of the bent of this article was, yes, it was to expose that going through this Biggest Loser process, you know, ruins your metabolism and makes things that much harder for you to maintain. But kind of the other attitude of it was, you know, once you've been fat, you're always at risk. It's just like you're never going to not be at that risk of regaining the weight.
Yeah, well, the wolf is always at the door.
Yeah. Right?
And I think it, I've always kind of assumed that it's because you have a taste for the things that make you fat, right? Like there are, I know people who are thin, they've always been thin. You know, they can see a plate of, you know, just out of the oven chocolate chip cookies and be like, oh, those look good. And they'll have one. And that's genuinely all that they want, right? And I do not do that. I look at that plate of cookies and I think to myself, who here do I have to put in a chokehold so that I can eat the entire plate of cookies, right? That's my emotional reaction. Intellectually, I understand that, you know, once I get beyond three or four cookies, they actually don't taste good anymore, right? They just, but I can't stop eating them.
Right.
And I just, you know, I just crave it irrationally. So,
and that's the thing, all these psychological issues and addiction issues and everything that was in place that made them be that overweight to begin with are all still there. And now he has, you know, the cards stacked against him with 800 fewer calories that his body is burning.
Yeah.
So it was just like, it was almost distressing to read this because I think these people are just screwed.
Well, it certainly, this whole article it reads like a train wreck, but it certainly leaves you with more questions than answers, right? And
I think in general, The Biggest Loser is a bad thing, and that's why I feel kind of guilty watching it, because, I mean, a very small percentage of everyone who's ever been on the show has had continued success.
Well, certainly these people, you know, have for a short period of time an unsustainable lifestyle, right? It's certainly not something that they'd ever going to be able to maintain going out into the future. But I suppose it makes for compelling television.
I guess.
So, all right, let's move on from one train wreck of a problem to a different one.
Okay.
Which is all of these articles about...
traveling airports.
Yeah, airport traveling woes. So the TSA is, I have to admit, my bias here, the TSA is not my favorite government agency. In fact, I am often reduced to a slobbering mess of invective if I'm discussing anything relating to the TSA. So I'm going to attempt not to do that here. But the TSA, is their claim that they do not have enough staffers and enough budget to do all of the screening that they need to do and as fast as they need to do it. And as such, even though we're not yet in the height of traveling season, right, in July and August, lines at airports are long, right? There are lots of anecdotal stories of people waiting for two or more hours just to get through the security, TSA security.
In this particular article that came out this week, I mean, there were people talking about waiting for up to 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've always been one of those people that, you know, when they say for a domestic flight, you should be at the airport 2 hours before your flight time. I always feel like there's a little wiggle room there. You know, if I'm there an hour, 90 minutes ahead of time, I don't think that's the case anymore. This makes me nervous, being someone who is always late and always likes having a little extra room.
Yeah, you're going to be in trouble.
I better change my ways.
Did you hear in the news a few months ago, the TSA was on the local news and they're talking about how they were making some changes for, you know, improved flow or whatever at the Minneapolis airport. And it basically, they were using a lot of crazy words that basically said, we're closing down one of the TSA checkpoints so that things can go faster. That's the 30-second review of what they said, which made no
logically,
sense to me
no.
at the time. You know, but they were claiming, you know, some unspecified improvements in their process are going to let everything go faster, right? Well, reading between the lines, what it comes down to is we closed checkpoint because we didn't have the staff or the money to staff all of the checkpoints we had.
Right.
Right. So show up early and prepare to wait a long time, right? And more people are flying now than have been flying in a long time. So, you know, the economy is doing relatively well. Americans are flying. You know, the airlines are making money. All good things, but it's overwhelming the TSA, which this article said they employ something like 42,000 people, which is kind of mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Take a breath. Don't get angry at the TSA. And so the, I don't know. It seems like it's going to be a disaster. Now, personally, I went through the process 2 years ago now to do TSA pre-check.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done this?
I haven't done this. You've told me about it before. And did you notice it was mentioned in this article? And there was one anecdote about someone who, even as a pre-check person, missed a flight because it still took in excess of an hour.
Yeah, though that's pretty rare.
Okay. What's your experience with pre-check?
Effortless. Okay. It's pre-9/11
security. What's the process on that? Like, you fill out forms, you get, like getting a clearance of some kind?
Yes. So there's an online component. You fill it out, you say who you are, you authorize them to do a background check. You make an appointment. And this is the part that becomes a pain in the tuchus. But you make an appointment and you have to go to some a TSA facility. At the time I did it, the nearest one was, you know, 75 miles away in the Twin Cities. So you make an appointment, you have to go there. You have to pay your fee. It's like $85. You have to have a bunch of documentation about who you are. If you have a passport, this becomes easy. You just give them your passport. They scan it, you fill out some forms, assuming your background check comes back and says you're not a crazed terrorist, which presumably you're not.
How little you know.
Then, you know, you fill out a little paperwork, it goes back into the system, and then a short period of time later, you get what's known as a known traveler number. And you can put this in your like frequent flyer profile with the airlines. So when you book a ticket, as long as they have your known traveler number in the system, mm-hmm. Then you get flagged as pre-check, and then you go through a different line, which is effectively pre-9/11 security, right? Keep your shoes on. You know, don't take your laptop out of your bag. Just put your bag on the belt. It gets x-rayed. You walk through the metal detector. You pick up your bag, and away you go.
All right.
They did say in this article, the TSA was hoping 25 million people would sign up for this, and like 2.5 million people have signed up for this. It's kind of a pain to do, like, because it's several steps.
Then how long does it last? Are you good
forever?
5 years.
Okay. 5 years. And global entry... So TSA PreCheck is only valid for domestic flights. Global entry is effectively the same thing, but it allows for, you know, returning to the United States from international destinations. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine had a bad experience going through security. I had encouraged him several times to do PreCheck or global entry, but he eventually had a bad experience going through security. Simply because he was coming back, he's doing international, so he's coming back, he's trying to go through customs, and there was something else that happened in the airport that caused the airport to be shut down for like 2 hours, or some other security incident, I don't know, somebody abandoned a bag or something, and so, you know, we overreact to this stupidity now.
So now customs is backed up by 2 hours.
Yeah, and he was with his children in a room, you know, where you go from the gate and you get corralled into this room, mm-hmm. you know, so they can control the people trying to get through customs. And normally you're only in here for a few minutes, but they were stuck in here with a bunch of people. I mean, the room was packed, you know, for 2 hours. There is no water fountains. There's no bathrooms. There's no place to sit down. Right. And so, you know, like this room was a powder keg, mm-hmm. right. Of people and emotion and fear and people just needed to go to the bathroom, right? I mean, you know, you can't lock people up in a room for 2 hours, right? And so he had this experience and came away from it saying, you know, never again, because there was one line over near the wall that was global entry, and those people were just walking through, right? It took them no time at all. It doesn't mean he still couldn't have been trapped, right? If, you know, if he had been in that line and had to wait. But right. the point was, it only would have taken him, you know, less than 10 minutes yes. to get through, as opposed to the half an hour to charge through the line as all 300 people got off the plane and had to go through customs. So, never again. And he found that his credit card, he has a fancy American Express card. Like, he started checking. American Express will pay for that for him and his family, right? So all of it's like $100 for global entry. Amex just paid for it, right? So he's like, all right, we're doing this, right? So him and his wife and his children, they've all gone through the process for global entry, and Amex paid for it, and now they can just swing through the line. Go figure. So I can't, once I get past my dislike of all of the security theater that all of this stuff is, I am a big fan of TSA PreCheck, and by extension, I'm a big fan of global entry, simply because it cuts down on the stupidity, and I can't recommend it enough. Yeah. So you should spend your $85 or maybe even $100.
I just don't travel that much. I fly
Doesn't
like
matter.
Once a year.
It doesn't matter.
So,
right? Yeah. If it saves you one time, then it's worth it, right? And even though you don't go through airports that often, every time you do go, you're going to see that big line, and instead you're going to say, ha ha, and go to the pre-check line, spend 5 minutes going through security, laughing at the idiots still taking off their belts and their shoes in the other line.
Which I do always find very stressful. I'm kind of a uptight person anyway, and traveling is very stressful for me. And getting through security, and it's like, belt off, shoes off, laptop out, you know, and there's always people pushing you behind, you know, from behind with their bins because they want to get through, and there's always somebody slow in front of you. And I just, like, it's very stressful. And then there's really nowhere when you get through to, like, get redressed. So,
yeah. You know, it's amazing to me that we, the American people, allow our government to force a level of indignity upon us that I find almost unimaginable with security.
Yeah.
Right? Like, every time you see somebody's 70-year-old grandmother getting a pat down, standing in her socked feet at security, I'm like, what have we come to?
Yeah.
Right. This
is... It's a lot of little simple things. I mean, if they just extended the conveyor belts for another, like, 8 to 10 feet, so you could continue to move with your baggage and get your stuff back out, you know, and reassemble yourself.
Yeah.
It'd be fine. It's the fact that it's just like, it comes out of the scanner, done, right there. You better get it, or it's going to get shoved, or it's a lot of really simple things.
Yeah.
Just more space.
Right.
Would fix a lot of the problems I have with it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, part of the problem is there isn't any space, because we've added this stupidity in to an existing airport, right? Which brings us to this other article about airports designed for everyone but the passenger, right? And, you know, the author of this article was lamenting that even new airports, while, you know, visually stunning, oftentimes are missing the details that make a passenger, you know, somebody who's actually using the airport for its intended purpose, it makes it almost impossible. The author was talking about being in a new airport. It was a very fancy airport designed by a famous architect, and he was at a gate, and the gate had an airplane, had some version of an Airbus that they were, you know, everybody's supposed to get on, and that Airbus can hold 150 passengers, and at the gate were 32 seats. The seats weren't very comfortable, and nowhere at the gate were there any outlets to charge your devices. I mean, it's almost inconceivable in the mm-hmm. modern era that would be the case, right? And so, at the end, it's kind of a ridiculous thing, right? Because the security process is so insane that you are forced to go to the airport
and spend more time waiting in a place that isn't designed for you to comfortably spend time in.
Right. You got to go there early. And, you know, every time, you know, if you really don't want to miss your flight because you're going on vacation and right, and so you agree that you're going to get there 3.5 hours before your flight leaves, well, you know, it's only going to take you on that day, you know, 75 minutes to get through security.
Right.
And now you've literally got to spend 2 hours wandering around the airport mm-hmm. waiting. So I need a comfortable place to sit. I need a place to plug in my crap, right? And this is what every traveler needs. You know, we can talk about, oh, these people aren't experienced travelers. Well, guess what? The subset of the traveling public that is a highly experienced traveler is pretty low and shrinking, because the number of road warriors in corporate America anymore is shrinking.
Right.
Because the internet. Everyone who comes to the airport is wildly inexperienced. Why can't you design this for the wildly inexperienced?
Yeah.
Disney seems to be able to do it. You can be wildly inexperienced and not have a horrible time waiting for 2 hours for a ride at Disneyland.
Right.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe Disney Imagineers need to start designing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's part of it. Yes, I will. I mean, I would be willing to believe that the TSA is understaffed, but I mean, it's a government agency, so it's not really an innovative, you know, innovative environment to begin with.
Yeah, by definition.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd be all for us not having the TSA, personally.
So then the other article that I had posted was entitled Avoiding the Dreaded Middle Seat. I don't know if you read that. It was maybe a month ago that I first read that. But when I was thinking about air travel, it reminded me about this article. And it's basically all about the great lengths people will go to not end up in the middle seat. When seats are being assigned.
Yeah. Have you sat in the middle seat lately?
I mean, last year I was on a flight. It was from Minneapolis to San Francisco through Houston. It was a long flight and I sat in the middle seat and it was not enjoyable, but it's a fact of life, right? If you don't, I bought a seat on the flight fairly late and that's all there was. So
The middle seat is usually not super comfortable, but it really depends on who's sitting on either side of you.
True.
I am not the thinnest gentleman in the world. The last couple of times that I've been stuck in a middle seat, I've usually had someone I know
traveling with you that you can borrow a little shoulder room from.
Yeah,
that's
from one side.
Useful.
And I think I've had relatively compact people on the other side.
Yeah.
Right. I have not had the misfortune of sitting in the middle seat when somebody as large as I am or larger is sitting on the other side.
Right.
Of me, because then it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I've also not had to sit in the middle seat and had people on the other side of me having an argument.
Yeah, that was in,
right.
In this article too.
I would probably, you know, try to get the stewardess to sort that out.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of crazy to me. The idea that to me, that's a very selfish thing to do when you have two travel companions, you know, husband and wife or, you know, travel companions who are somehow traveling together, and they elect rather than to pick two seats together where one person sits in the middle and one person sits on either the aisle or the window, to say we're going to pick the aisle seat and we're going to pick the window seat, you know, and make some other poor schlub come and sit between us, seems weird to me. Anytime I've traveled with someone and we've picked our seats, we pick two seats together and then just take turns having the good seat.
The plane only has single seats. And so you're sitting like eight rows apart because that's all there was.
Right.
It's last minute. I'm on this plane and we're sitting far apart and that's okay. And then you're effectively traveling as two single people, which is fine. But I don't understand the leave the middle seat for some schlub in between. But
yeah. Because what if it ends up being somebody, you know, who is a large person? Like you're ultimately going to be cause problems. So yeah, I mean, I'm a bigger guy, but I have fairly broad shoulders, but I am used to, you know, in theater seats and many other situations other than airline seats, you know, I kind of tuck my arms in, you know, I tuck my arms in to try and not be out in other people's shoulder room and then just hunker down and deal. And on this flight, there actually was a big guy. He wasn't really fat. He was just like a really broad guy next to me on one side. But he had a really good attitude. And from the very beginning, we were kind of like, we're in this together, buddy.
That's right.
We're going to make it, you know? And at one point we stood up and kind of walked around a little bit. And so that makes the biggest difference on flights when you're in, you know, not great seating arrangements, is if you're around people who are, you know, humans.
Sure.
Who like
understand this is uncomfortable.
We're just trying to get somewhere on a shitty, crappy airplane, you know, like we can do this.
Well, and we're in the middle of the country. Yeah. So it's almost impossible to be on a plane unless you're going over an ocean for more than 3 or 3.5 hours. Right. I mean, that's just about the length of to either coast from here. Right.
Yeah.
So, it's not probably going to be the most enjoyable 3.5 hours of your life, but
it's tolerable.
It's tolerable.
So on that same trip, there was another segment of a flight where I was again in a middle seat and my buddy was on one side. And then there was this woman on the other side and I come onto the plane, she had a blanket on her lap. And I always kind of like, I hope that this person isn't upset, you know, like, oh great, I got a fat guy next to me, you know, we're going to be cramped, whatever. I sit down and, you know, she was very nice and whatever. And then I look and peeking out from under the blanket on her lap were two chihuahuas. She had like service dogs on her lap. And then I was like, okay, I'm not going to be the problem in this row now. It's like she has absolutely no room to complain about anything because she has dogs.
She's got dogs
on her lap.
On the airplane.
So it actually was like, it was almost like this huge relief. she's worse than me. I'm not going to be the problem. And there were all kinds of problems with these chihuahuas on the flight. But
of course, not really.
Dogs. Because they're dogs on a plane. That's not how it's supposed to work. Wow. You know, that flight too, the last couple flights I've taken, actually, I've had this deal where when I go to book my flight, if it's fairly late, there's no seats available. You can't pick a seat because all of the available seats are the upgrade seats.
Yep.
So it's like if you want an exit row, and they keep lumping more and more seats into these like extra fee seat categories.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to pick your seat, you got to pay. That always makes me really nervous to have to arrive at the gate
and get
unassigned, unassigned.
Well,
because
you know
until I have
a seat number,
I have a seat number, I'm not sure I'm going to get on that plane.
So like with Delta's economy comfort, depending on what it costs, if it's a long enough flight, I don't mind paying for the economy comfort usually if I can get a window or an aisle seat. I think the fact that they want to charge the same price for economy comfort
for
the
middle seat. I don't care if I have an extra 8 inches of leg room.
Yeah, those guys are clearly smoking something, right? Because the middle seat, even in economy comfort, is not worth it.
Right.
You have more front to back, but there's no wider.
Exactly.
Right? If it was wider, it'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. And so why is that worth the same money? It isn't. Oftentimes, if you're looking on Delta, the economy comfort is the aisle and window seats are gone. And the only thing that's left in economy comfort is the middle seat. And people have kind of learned, it's not worth it,
right?
You know, if you're a frequent flyer, you're like, maybe I'll get an upgrade to that seat for free. It's not worth paying the $40 or $50 or sometimes $80 to sit in the middle seat because...
Yeah, unless you really want to make sure you have a guaranteed assigned seat.
Well, or the other thing that can be worth it is if you're going to have a tight connection, that gets you to the front of that cabin.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't necessarily get you to the front of the plane, but it gets you to the front of the economy cabin.
Right.
Which can...
Can make a difference.
It can make a difference because... you know, I've already said most people are inexperienced travelers, but they're inexperienced travelers and have no capacity to wrangle their luggage, right? Like, I know you're going for 4 days to Florida, but why did you bring 112 pounds of luggage and then not be able to carry it?
Right.
Right. What is wrong with you? Mm. You don't need that much crap, but there it is, right? So every person takes their 2 minutes to get their crap and try to get out of the plane, so...
Yeah.
I did the article did mention a guy who says he oftentimes buys two seats just for him.
Yeah.
Like he buys his seat and the middle seat so that he can be assured that no big sweating fat guy, you know, shows up next to him. And he's like, and this is cheaper than buying business class, which probably is. I mean, I want to sit next to that guy, right? He can buy the middle seat, and I'll sit next to him.
Right,
and we'll
in the aisle, exactly.
And we'll both have the...
And buy him a drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting what this article went into, like, kind of like the trading that happens in order to trade seats. Like, I'll buy you a drink, or, like, offer you cash, or, like, haggling that goes into people trying to get, you know, different seats once they get on the plane. And techniques people use in order to get out of the middle seat. And I think the article ends saying a woman who... Oh, I gave up my aisle seat because she cried. And if you cry, you always win.
I feel like...
Would you give up your aisle seat, Matt, for a crying woman?
It's tough to know, but I feel like the answer would be no. Just because that would push me the wrong way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm, for better or worse, if you tell me to do something, I'm likely to do the opposite just to be mean to you. Right? That's just my default answer, right? And, you know, no. If you wanted an aisle seat, you should have bought it. It's my preference to sit here, and I paid the money for the ticket. Shut up. That would probably be my default answer, right? And I'm sure everybody around me would hate me, but you know what? Screw them. I don't know. I would... Maybe I would, but I really don't think so. Right. I wonder if you could you start a web service to rate your passengers? Like, could you have like a Yelp for your airline passengers? Maybe the airlines could do that, right? Because you're not necessarily going to know what their name is, but it could be like, man, I sat in 36C and this crazed lunatic in 36B next to me did all of these horrible things, right? They are a one-star passenger. And so then when you're picking your seat in the cabin, all of the passengers that have a rating could like,
see it.
You know, this seat is occupied by a one-star, yeah. Right? And so the airlines might be forced to have dynamic pricing based on who's in the seats, right? If you're a one star, you know, there's a $20 your stupid fee,
right,
for any seat that you choose, because we got to charge $20 less for the seats adjacent to you. But if you're a five star, right, maybe we
get a deal.
We give you a $30 discount on your seat,
right? Because people will pay a premium to sit next to you.
Exactly, because you're a good passenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be,
I like it.
That would be interesting. I suppose ultimately most people on an airplane don't travel often enough,
right,
for it to matter. But that's kind of what you want to know, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm willing to sit in the middle seat if I know that the people on either side of me aren't a-holes, you know, and aren't going to be spilling over their seat.
Right.
Right. But if, you know, the person in the window seat's 427 pounds and kind of smells, then I don't really want to sit in the middle seat, right? I'll take a different flight. Yeah. Huh.
Get on that.
That's what I'm going to do to win the internet lottery, right? Rate your passengers. All right. What else should we talk about?
Is there anything else on the list?
Did you read that fail once a day?
Oh, article? I did. Sure, that'd be a good way to wrap up here. So it was basically a guy talking about how kind of like self-betterment plan, mm-hmm, was to do something every day that challenged him or something that he was maybe likely to fail, or there was potential failure involved in this thing he was attempting to do.
Right.
Every day. And then document it, or, you know.
And it seemed to be, the trick was to both document it and pick something. And they ranged all over the map. Like, he talked about... Yeah. You know, his entrepreneur, right? So he talked about trying to, you know, find a lead and close a deal in a day, right? Which is maybe an irrational thing to do. But just as, yeah, a challenge, like on some random, mm-hmm, Tuesday, okay, I'm going to see if I can,
right,
you know, get this lead and get their business and get it closed in a day, right? I mean, maybe you succeed, maybe you don't.
Yeah.
But then another challenge was, you know, make a really great cheeseburger.
Right. So a lot of it wasn't necessarily... try to fail every day. A lot of them fell into the category of trying something new every day. And when you're trying something new, there's this inherent,
yeah,
possibility of failure, right? Because it's something you haven't done before. So a lot of them were in that camp. Like, it was almost more like, I kind of liked that, thinking about it that way, trying something new or something that is a challenge for me every day, rather than phrasing it like trying to fail every day. Like, logically, that didn't really inspire me, I guess.
Well, maybe the wording of it is specific to indicate that the the success or failure of the thing that you're trying isn't important, right? Failure is okay. It's right. that you tried it. That's the key here.
Yeah.
So don't beat yourself up for failing.
True.
Just keep going.
I guess like in the context of exercise, you know, if I'm going to do something to failure, the idea is I'm going to lift a weight until I can't lift it anymore. Like failure is the goal.
Right.
This made me kind of think that like, it's like, I'm trying to stretch myself so far that I'm, you know, guaranteed to fail. That wasn't really the point of it, but
I don't know that I could do it every day. Yeah. I feel like trying to think of something new to do every day would probably cause me a lot of stress.
Yes.
Once a week, maybe.
You would have to have a lot of like relatively easy or not time consuming things kind of in the bank. I'm sure he had a list of 50 things that, you know, when I don't have time to do something, particularly, you know, to some time sink or endeavor today, I'm going to do this cook a burger thing off the list, you know.
Maybe. I don't know. I wonder how many times he got to like 10 o'clock at night. He was like,
I
got to
do my thing.
And then, you know, I don't know. What would you do at that point, right? I'm going to try crocheting. And then you spend 5 minutes on YouTube. Okay, I failed. I move on. Like, I don't know. What do you do there? That's a tough thing.
Yeah, it was interesting. And the article talked a little bit about, which I identified with, time passing, like the amount of time that can pass without really accomplishing anything, you know, or bettering yourself in any way.
Yep.
And this was kind of a device to counteract that, you know, I can't go entire weeks or months without any sort of personal growth because I'm forcing myself, you know, to do these things daily, which I did like that idea. Sometimes I feel like entire weeks or months pass where I haven't really accomplished anything, you know, accomplished no lasting thing or no lasting bit of personal growth. And that doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I guess it depends how you define personal growth, right? Because you and I are going to the gym. I mean, you're going 6 days a week, right? And I'm probably going 4 to 5. So I know that I am often, you know, every week in the gym in some way making some new gain, right? Either running a little bit longer or, you know, setting a new personal best, lifting some weight or something, right? So at least in that regard, I feel like I'm making some forward progress every week. But there are other areas of my life
True.
Where I've probably not made a lot of forward progress. And I might wish that to change, but I haven't allocated the time to do it, I guess. So maybe that's what it comes down to. It's a time allocation thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do feel that, like, getting to the gym, exercising, working out, that kind of thing is an accomplishment. The problem I've run into with that, especially more so lately, is if that's become, you know, your source of growth or accomplishment, and then you haven't achieved something long term, then I start kind of thinking, well, you know, did I really accomplish anything? Was that a waste of time? Like, you know, I do this fitness class and I work out 6 days a week and I do that for 6 months and I haven't lost any weight. Now it's like, well, you know, how can I say that was the focus of my personal growth? And now what have I really accomplished? So
this would be an argument for you to choose to step on the scale.
Right. Yeah.
During this period of time that you're taking this class.
I've experienced that in the past too, you know, when I've set long-term fitness goals and the short-term goal of getting, you know, my butt into the gym, yes, does feel like an accomplishment. But then if you don't achieve that long-term goal, it starts to kind of like, I don't know, lessen the achievement of all those daily struggles. I don't know.
So there's a Japanese word called Kaizen. And the basic premise is, you know, if you achieve a number of very, very, very tiny cumulative goals, you will eventually achieve a big goal, right? And so the basic premise is to break things down into smaller and smaller and smaller steps such that eventually each additional, you know, forward step in of progress is so small you can't help but to complete it. And so this is how you can, you know, do some overwhelming task. You break it down and, you know, over time you'll eventually achieve a gazillion tiny little steps and then have done something big. This is the basic premise behind get things done, right? You know, if you've ever studied that process, right? You know, your action list is...
I got as far as buying the book. Does that count?
Yeah, so, you know, in Get Things Done, it wouldn't be, you know, understand GTD. It would be, you would break down the next step to be so small that there's no ambiguity about what it is, right? So the next step is maybe read the first five pages, right? Something that's so tiny that you're like, oh, that's really easy. Okay, I did that. What's my next step? Well, let's read the next five pages, right? Until eventually you're done, right?
Right.
And so as opposed to having this task of lose 50 pounds, right?
Right.
You would, well, that if that's your goal, you're never going to get there, right? So you would break it down and say, step one, you know, cut out the bowl of ice cream I have every night before I go to bed, right? And that, you know, that's one simple thing, right? And you would keep breaking the next step down,
right?
So that there's no ambiguity about what it is. You can write down very clearly, you know, tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to do this thing, right? And I know exactly what it is and I don't have any ambiguity. So there's no mental friction in the way of you doing what the next appropriate step is, right? You take this planning cycle, does all the heavy lifting, so that you're just left with the action that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a common, that basic process of taking a big goal, breaking it down into tiny little steps along the way is a very common thing that you see all over the place, right? But the key to it is having a planning cycle that gets you to the next tiny little step, right? You know,
right.
Somewhere along the way, you keep track of all of the, you know, what's my big goal again? And I'm here. What's the next step I got to do to get there, right?
Right.
It's not hard.
Which makes sense. I do still think there's a little bit of a difference because in fitness and weight loss, there's so much room to backpedal, to lose what you've gained. Like, I'm going to read a book and I'm going to read five pages every day. There's no unreading those five pages. You know, I guess you could argue that if I go long enough without continuing, I'll forget them and have to reread them, yada, yada. Well, if I'm putting together a puzzle and I put each piece in, there's no risk that those pieces are going to come back out before I put the next piece in.
You got a cat, of course.
And, yeah. There's very little risk. But as far as fitness and weight loss goes, you know, if I don't continue with the next step, like I might gain that pound back, you know, just not making that correct, you know, eating decision. I feel like there's so much room to go back on your accomplishments and erase them is what makes it harder for that to be your personal growth focus.
Well, but the thing you're trying to do is affect a lifestyle change. And so even though you might, you know, make mistakes or slip back, right, then that's just your next step again, right?
A new step is inserted that is
redo
that thing that I undid.
Right. And part of it, you know, it'd be things like when you get to the office, don't take the elevator, right? Take the stairs, at least for one floor, right? Get on the elevator at the second floor and go up to the eighth floor, right? And then eventually get on the elevator at the third floor, right? Or, you know, eventually keep getting on the elevator at the third floor, but then always walk down. Right. Just little tiny things, right, where you keep making improvements, right? The example in the Kaizen book I read was it's super tiny, like during commercials from your TV show that you're watching, stand up. That's it. Just stand up. And when that's easy, then march in place during the commercials, right? And then when that's easy, you know, march in place during the commercials in for a minute or two afterwards until eventually, you know, you're on a treadmill running while you're watching The Biggest Loser or whatever it is that you're watching, right? But, you know, that first step of, as opposed to sitting for the 30 minutes of the TV show, standing up during the commercials, well, everybody can stand up,
right?
That's just, it's such a tiny, easy little step that you can do it, right? And then you keep adding to that and adding to that and adding to that. And you'll eventually get somewhere, right? This is almost how software development works, right? Keep making little improvements, fix that bug, add this thing, keep going, And 5 years down the road, you have this big, complicated, ugly, hairy mess of things that does some fancy stuff, if you're lucky. So, I don't know. That's really what I got out of this article, right? It was a, you try some tiny thing every day just to push myself out of my, out of my humdrum, you know, daily grind in an effort to learn something. All right. What else we got to talk about?
That's all I got.
Okay. It's good because I'm out of coffee.
Me too.
See ya.
Next time.